excellent attitude towards foreign language and racist chanting. BBC News. In a hour's time here on Radio 4, there's our classic funeral. Having been forced to flee the Nazis, Anna and her family have now arrived in London. Out of the Hitler time, bombs are meant daily by Digit Car just after 9. First, archive on 4, and you have an opportunity to relax. Christine Sin reflects on how recorded natural sound became a commercial proposition, and possibly more than just whale music.
It was a hot summer night. I couldn't sleep and longed for the sound of rain. I googled for it on my laptop and found so many possibilities. Rain on a tin hut roof in Hawaii, in a forest, falling into the rush of a waterfall. I wasn't alone. There were 2 million hits on YouTube. Others were out there, searching, like me, for the sound of other people's weather.
Viking, North of Sierra, South of Sierra, Porters, Dollar, Fisher, Down by, Rain, and Good, becoming moderate. Visibility, moderate, all good. Sound, moderate, alter. Shower at first, visibility, becoming cyclonic for a time later. Northwest of the airflow will back southwest here to time, and a warm front moves southeast across the country.
By the sea, and some years ago I bought a cassette recording of the sound of shingle rasping on a Kent beach. It got me thinking about other, more exotic beaches, Ibiza and the sound of the 90s, all built around the notion of chilling for the music and atmosphere. I feel relaxed every time I hear Groove Armada's 1997 track, At the River, a staple of the Ibiza scene. It's often described as one of the most laid-back tunes of all time, evoking the sounds of a beach without a single wave in earshot. Fascination with the real sound is clearly potent. Why else would they still stop that Kent Beach recording in our local music shop, now on CD and a bestseller? I wanted to be able to evoke memories of the beach of my childhood, and that hot night when I wanted to hear rain, more than 2 million others were also seeking out their own memories.
I think that we're more separated from them. The natural sounds in our world today, if you live in a very urban environment, they can appear to be lost. And having these recordings is a way to instantly retrieve them. It's like a timeless gift of nature that the slightest of fingertips.
They put it on just quietly in the background, almost imperceptibly, and it changes the mood of a room. It changes people's view of life, I think. Like having a window open.
There's something incredibly relaxing, for example, about listening to something like a river flowing, partly because it never settles. It's never the same thing twice, and yet, of course, it sounds infinitely familiar somehow.
Anybody who gets put on hold and they phone up wild sounds actually, of course, gets to listen to some wildlife sounds. And it's actually quite amazing how people who sounded quite strict and they phone you about an order not being received or something rather like that, suddenly when you get them back on the phone, they say, oh my, that was fantastic, I'm feeling so gracious and actually fun. So I do think it has an amazing power.
You start to get letters from dentist surgery. saying, I put the sound of the birds on, and it calms my patients down.
Record songs of the humpback whale instantly became a hit, and it still is the best-selling nature sound recording of all time. Once they heard the song, people started crying. It moved them to tears, and they realized these animals were doing something beautiful and interesting that they really didn't understand. One of the standing jokes with some of the people I knew very well at H&V was that our Atmosphere CDs at that stage were actually outselling Madonna and Madonna's backlist, which was quite amazing.
It's 11:20. This is On the Hour.
On the Hour.
Such is politics, the pain of business.
On the Hour.
The power of natural sound, from birdsong to waves and whales, has a hippie crystal in it that's often sent up.
Time to go over to the Green Desk for some environmental news.
Green Desk.
Environmental news with me, Rosie May. The organisers of the 200-mile Morven to Natchez whale walk have fallen at the first hurdle. That's because whales can't walk and find almost any form of motion on land beyond their capabilities.
Environmental news. It is green, we'll cover it.
The association of manufactured relaxation with beauty spas and New Age practice means there's a commercial side to it all. Yet it wasn't for commercial reasons, or even hippy-dippy ones, that Duncan MacDonald started his label Wild Sounds in the late 1980s, but to educate the British in natural history. MacDonald was a vet who'd come to Britain from South Africa in 1986.
When I first arrived in Britain, I was quite shocked to discover that birdwatchers didn't actually know what bird sounds were. You know, the first time I was up in Norfolk, I heard a very high-pitched sound. There were about four or five bird watchers, you know, around, and I asked them what it was, and they said they didn't know, and I discovered basically it was a goldfish. And I was quite shocked that nobody knew bird sounds. Having bird watched in South Africa, if you went out birding in the morning, you know, and you came back with a list of over 150 species or something, 70% of those would actually have been just heard. You wouldn't have seen the birds because of the, you know, dense acacia scrub and so on. So I started looking around and discovered that the British Library had produced some cassettes of bird songs. They hadn't marketed them very well. And I started to put together a catalogue from around the world, from Venezuela, Australia and so on, mainly sound guides to teach bird watchers about bird sounds and so on. We went off to various trade events and discovered there was a fantastic demand for these. At the same time, CDs, you know, had been long this in the mid-80s, and we discovered a producer in France was about to produce the first ever CDs of birdsong. He was looking for somebody in the English market to back him, and together we then produced the first ever CDs of birdsongs of Europe. And that set of CDs is still sold to this day, and if back in 1990 there had been some way in which we could have actually put that set of CDs onto the chart, it would have gone platinum several times over.
We do seem to be particularly drawn to birdsong. Who can forget that extraordinary duet by the cellist Beatrice Harrison with a nightingale? Recorded by the BBC in Harrison's garden in 1924, it was the first ever live broadcast of birdsong. From one garden to another nearly 70 years later, Sound engineer Quentin Howard's Wiltshire Garden on a foggy October morning in 1991, where he recorded what was to become a 35-minute tape loop, which had gone on to have a life of its own. I visited him to talk about the fledgling radio bird song above the sound of a Chinook helicopter hovering overhead.
I was trying to record something which would work for this local amateur dramatic production of Raymond Briggs' When the Wind Blows, the one about the nuclear bomb. And halfway through the play, the bomb goes off and all natural life ceases. And in order to get this across, I wanted to put birdsong into the auditorium, just a very low level, so as people came into the theatre, took their seats in the first half of the play start, these birds are twittering away in the background, but not obtrusively. The idea was nobody would really notice until the crush of the bomb going off, and then you turn the birds off, and the silence would be deafening. It achieved all of that back in 1991. But then I put the recording in the drawer and forgot about it. And a year later, I was building a national radio station, Classic FM. I was responsible for building all the transmitters in the studio. And the rules require that when you put a transmitter on to test it, you have to get some sound out. You can't leave it silent. Well, being that we were launching a competitive radio station for the BBC, we didn't want to give our game away by playing classical music to show what we might be made of. So I rang Michael Butt up, dear Michael Butt, who was the president of the show, and I said to him, can we put birds on instead of music? And without hesitation, he said, yes, what a great idea. So on the Monday, we were broadcasting birds around the country. So for those 2 months during the summer of 1992, while we were testing our transmitters, all the country heard was 35-minute tape of birdsong, the original one that I had recorded for When the Wind Blows, in this garden, and it just took off from there. Newspapers started to ask, what is birds going on the radio? People would write letters into the Telegraph and so on, and even on Test Match Special, Brian Johnson said one day, I was driving down the road on my way to the Test Match here, and I heard these birds singing on the radio. It must have caused apoplexy back at the BBC because it was creating publicity for this new radio station, which, you know, somebody didn't want.
This is an engineering test transmission for Classic FM, Britain's first independent national radio station.
And we get letters into the radio station during that summer from dentist surgery. I put the bird song on because it comes with my patient's sound. Waiting room, Foxwood waiting room. We put it in the background and it stopped from shouting to the receptionist. And I had a letter from a prisoner in Wandsworth saying, I haven't heard birds for 20 years. Having this on the radio has made it all worthwhile again, and I remember what life outside was like. And just really poignant stories like that. People would write in and say, I use this to put my children to sleep at night. And that was a recurring theme. And then, of course, when you bought the radio station, that all went away because the tape went back in the drawer again. And then 7 years later, I was building digital radio, DAB, around the UK, and I had to launch new transmitters. So guess what I did? I ran the birdsong tape again on DAB transmitters. And once again, it started people talking, and the newspapers got hold of this. And once or twice since then, we brought it back, and we've had a spare slot on the national digital radio network. And it's had exactly that same interest. And it's been going for 20 years now. It's something to be proud of. Is it radio history?
More than a decade before Radio Birdsong first warbled onto the airwaves, history was being made on the other side of the Atlantic, when natural sounds were taken into space on a Voyager probe NASA launched in the summer of 1977. These were from the Environment label, which had brought birdsong and a host of other natural sound to record shops since the start of the 70s. When I craved the sound of rain, I found an infinite variety of weather sounds. Cool downpours on a hot tin roof, thunderstorms in far-off places, crashing Hawaiian waves, all sorts of weather to tap into. And I was intrigued to know where it came from. I stumbled across the name Irving Tidal in Austin, Texas, and his environments label. Irv was a man who loved fast cars, but he was also a pioneer of natural sound. He died in 2010. His daughter, Jennifer Barrow, told me about him.
He began as a graphic designer and got into recording natural sounds when he studied electronic music in Austin. This was in the late 50s. After some years, he found it hard to do anything pleasant, as he likes to say, in electronic music. And he described this to a friend at Bell Labs. And his friend was doing work in white noise, which involves a broad band of sound at all frequencies produced by an electronic device. Architects and others were using this white noise to blot out unwanted noises. So my dad got the idea to use natural sounds for that purpose. When he initially got the idea, he realized how big it was and described it as waking up and being on top of an elephant, so to speak.
So he was a real pioneer in both aspects, in the technology, but also in actually grabbing this natural sound and using it in another way.
Absolutely. You know, it had been done, of course, before him, but he was one of the first people to really market it correctly. And also, he understood what made it really listenable. He grew up in a classical music environment. His father played the violin, and he was interested in recording his brother's concerts. So he had a lot of classical music training to the ear, and I think that helped him understand what makes rhythmic music satisfying. The most popular use for the recording were for those living in very urban environments like New York City. They needed natural sounds to help mask the chaos around them outside. And so those were his key customers. And also people that needed to tune out, so people that were studying, they would need something to tune other things out.
And as a child, were you lulled to sleep by the heartbeat or the suffering of his recordings?
When I was an infant, they were absolutely used. He would use Ultimate Thunderstorm and Slow Ocean, even the cricket. There are actually tons of uses that evolved. Something that was really popular was to help pets with their being afraid of thunderstorms. So a whole market developed from that.
Apart from animal therapy, natural sounds seem to evoke our memories in an almost Proustian fashion. Madeleine may have done it for Marcel, but today's well-traveled customer has more exotic memories. So Duncan McDonald's Wild Sounds Market has expanded way beyond birdsong.
People are wanting an evocative atmosphere. They're wanting to be able to remember going off to, you know, the wilds of Kenya, and every morning they heard the strange sound. And they discovered later that it was a Hardy-Dar ibis, and those sounds, if they play them back, it just evokes the feeling of being on that African safari. Having a barbecue to the sounds of the African bush, or, you know, sitting in your bath and relaxing to the sounds of Australia or the sounds of the Amazon.
You can be on the African savannah within your back garden and Surrey.
And, you know, even better, you can be in the middle of winter when it's dark and visible outside. You can put a soundscape of nightingales and instantly be transported back into a nice hot summer evening, and they'll just feel so much better about it.
My name is Eleanor Watkins. I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Surrey, and I'm looking at the restorative effects of listening to natural sounds on people's movement attention, particularly after stress or fatigue.
Why is it different the natural sound is so restorative.
Well, there are a number of theories in the area. The first is more evolutionary and more emotionally focused. It's just that experience in natural environments tends to evoke feelings of security and safety because they're present natural environments. And because those are the environments that we evolved in, that can lead to feelings of feeling happier after stress or negative experiences. So we might feel more secure in those environments. The second theory is more cognitive or more attention focused. And it suggests that natural environments have a lot of qualities that are present to experience and they help us to restore our attentional capacity after fatigue. There's one study that suggests that when natural sounds are absent, people miss them and they notice that they're not there. And there's also one particular study that came out last year that suggests that listening to natural sounds like birdsong, looks like the sounds of a water fountain, can help people to recover from physiological stress faster than the sounds in the built environment.
What's the problem if we don't get enough natural sound?
I think it can leave us feeling a bit detached from our environment, particularly because this sound is very evocative. That's what I'm finding, certainly in the course of my research, that it evokes certain memories and associations and symbolises a lot of experiences for people. So, for example, I associate seagulls with a closing time at Whitechapel Market, whereas some people might associate seagulls with the sound of the sea, the beach, and that kind of thing.
Do you think there are certain sounds that go beyond cultures as well? I think it's very like an earth sound, a real sound, maybe it goes back to the room, heartbeat, everybody seems to get and feel relaxed by.
I think the sound of water seems to be a common theme amongst people, and this is what I'm finding. Maybe there's something room-like about that, so I'm not sure quite yet. But yeah, I think certainly there are things that seem to be common to people that you find in all cultures. But I think perhaps the symbolism, particularly of different bird sounds, might need to be explored cross-culturally, because what one bird might symbolize in one culture might be completely different from another. So where some things might be constant, I think other things might shift or change cultures.
What about you personally? What do you like to hear?
I like the wren. I think that's a very pretty bird. I love the sound of the wren. I like lying in my bed and hearing it on the roof of buzzing when I'm trying to fall asleep. I think that's quite so soothing. I think the sound of the sea is always quite soothing. I like that so much.
You could understand one night when I couldn't sleep and looking for the sound of rain on my laptop.
Yeah, no, I can absolutely understand that. I think there's quite interesting kind of online culture out there. You get all these people uploading videos of different soundtracks to YouTube. This is great for an anecdotal evidence about how people feel. I think it's really important to back that up with the science as well.
This apparent need for natural sound has been exploited by companies such as Wild Sound. Duncan MacDonald calls his soundscapes atmospheres, but they could just as well be labelled ambulances. They're true, unmanipulated recordings of the environment in question. And they're used to elicit the same effect that Brian Eno sees.
A piece of music becomes real for me when it seems to become a place, you know, where I can sort of feel what the temperature would be, and what the light that would go with it would be, and what colours. I should start making music deliberately to create a more desirable reality.
Eno is known as the godfather of ambient music. His famous music for airports was certainly an improvement on the usual experience in that particular reality. But I wonder whether Eno's inspiration comes more from the natural than the built environment.
My hobby when I was a kid was collecting fossils. And I didn't know anyone else who liked doing that, so it was something I did on my own. And I would cycle off to places that I'd heard about, like Sutton Crag and various beaches and so on. And I would just take some sandwiches with me and spend a day looking at stones, really. And I remember that very clearly as being very happy and transcendent time. Beyond thinking, actually.
And it's precisely this quality of being beyond thought that expresses our connection with natural sound. It seems to find a pathway to something instinctual inside us.
A lot of the innovations of ambient music was leaving out the idea that there should be a melody, or words, or a beat.
You see, word is ambient, and ambient describes a certain sort of vibe in the music. Like any label, it means different things to different people, and for a lot of people that I know who are on the scene, ambient implies quite a degree of freedom in the type of music. But yeah, this is music for the spirit and the head as well. This is spiritual music. For me, something like music for a musician, I see Brian, on occasion, literally brings tears to my eyes. some of the newer ambient, they call ambient music of the 90s and probably beyond. I don't really keep up, but I think a lot of that is more rhythmic and it's related to the club scene. It's like they have a chill out room where people, you know, after they've been dancing, they want to listen to something a little quieter. But that's not really the kind of ambient that I listen to.
Or the kind of ambient music that Kit Watkins makes. Formerly a rock musician with American band Happy the Man and British band Camel, Kit was inspired by Brian Eno's ambient music, but also by Wendy Carlos's use of natural sounds.
Wendy Carlos is one of the early ones because in the mid-70s she did the Sonic Seasonings album. Quite an amazing landmark, really, that album, because I don't think anyone had done nature sounds with music and more artistic expressions than she did at that point. This particular album, when I heard it, it took me a while for it to sink in. It was something I would sit and would even sometimes sleep to, because it was just really unusual and brought me back to nature sounds, but in a kind of ethereal and kind of mystical way, I would say.
Does it evoke memories of places you've been and sounds you've heard, or was it something completely new?
It was really something new. I mean, of course, some things are familiar, storms and rain or whatever, but no, she had a way of, you know, combining all that to make it much more fascinating and useful.
From ambient music that replicates the effects of natural sounds to music that plays with natural sounds. Richard Watkins, everything changed when he moved to the mountains of North Carolina in 1987.
You could hear all these sounds, the traffic was gone, and all the busy streets and everything. So it was just all this wildlife, all kinds of birds and deer, and I collected a lot of sounds. I was recording storms and rain and brooks and different birds. So, 1991, I think it was 1991 when I did Circle, that album was devoted totally to the idea of blending nature and music.
Natural sound Kit uses, he manipulates it for various reasons.
You know, I had a sampler at the time when I was doing that album, so I could easily place the sounds in any time frame and then manipulate them too, of course, and that made it a lot of fun to, you know, put an owl in a place where maybe it would be rhythmically or musically interesting. And then, of course, I discovered an interesting phenomenon like the hummingbirds. I recorded them at regular speed. They just sounded like a bunch of chirping sounds. And then I slowed it down about 3 octaves, maybe 4. And it sounds female. It's kind of haunting and unusual, but it's completely different. And it's almost like you've taken a microscope and looked at it so you can see what's really going on with the hummingbird, but you couldn't possibly pick it up at the normal speed.
When you say it sounds human, does it sound more like a human voice or a singing voice?
There's a single tone that does sound almost like a soprano singing. And then there's these other fluttering sounds. And you realize, oh, that's a hummingbird? There's no way, you know, because it doesn't sound like it, but it's been detuned. But that's all it's been done. It's just slowed it down and changed the pitch in the process. The same as you would have a tape recorder. There's a sampler from that easier, so I'm just using the technology from the end. So.
And it's not only musicians that have used the technology to change natural sounds. Irving Tribal decided he could improve on nature.
With the fact that he could manipulate the sounds could something more pleasant and relaxing that made him so successful? The slow ocean is the best example. He leaves it and then he would slow it down to the speed that he thought was appropriate.
Radio Birdsong was also engineered. Quentin Howard.
This wasn't a single recording. This is two or three recordings overlaid. And one of the things I did discover is if you just go out and record a dawn chorus, lots of people have tried to copy this third recording, and they think it's a dawn chorus. It's not. So the dawn chorus is actually quite annoying. If you hear one bird singing its song for 5 minutes, and my goodness, that gets annoying after a while. And I was very careful with this recording, this original Birdsong recording, not to do that. There was a horse in the background.
Oh, my
God. Yes, the gunshot became a bit of a story in its own. People said, you know, what's this gunshot? They're always trying to identify all this myriad of sounds. It isn't a gunshot. In fact, the house had some wooden barge boards on the side. And in the morning sun, as the mist was rising, they were heating up and they were expanding. And that was the noise. I thought they were interesting noises, so I left them in. Because for no reason, it was just a part of the sound, so why take it out? So you can begin to hear some crows in the background. But it is a bit artificial. If you went outside and recorded this, it wouldn't quite sound like this. Because nature doesn't perform on cue. So it is a bit of a cheat, but it was done deliberately to create a compressed sound of nature.
I guess natural sound is the ultimate ambient. In fact, I'm thinking about John Cage's piece called 4 Minutes and 30 Seconds. It was a piece where the performer came out, had his piano, opened the music, and sat for 4 minutes and 33 seconds. He never played the piano. Well, the idea was everything in the room created the composition. People moving their programs and maybe somebody talking or whatever. If you think about nature, then if you just go out into nature, whatever time of day it is, there's always going to be some real and natural sound going on. So if we start listening to that, we can think of that as a composition. We can think of that as a musical background to our lives.
We can all be ambient composers.
Oh, there you go. That's exactly right. A revolution has happened in music in the last somewhere between 30 and 50 years.
Composer Matthew Herbert.
Up until that point, music really had been forms of impressionism. And then the invention of the microphone, and then the tape machine, and then the sampler. Music could also be documentary. Prior to that, music would just have to be about something, whereas music now can actually be that thing. So rather like in visual art, the shift from painting and drawing to photography and then to video, music has undergone that same revolution, and now we can make music about and with anything. The whole world becomes our keyboard, if you like. So previously, for example, if Elgar wanted to describe the role of English Hills, he would have to use great string lines, and he would try to have to somehow emulate the colours and the feeling of the English countryside. And yet now we can go out with our tape recorders and record those, whether it be the bird song or dairy farmers going out of business or whatever it might be, and turn that into music. That seems to be an incredible opportunity. Both musically, socially, politically, and intellectually. For me, what's really exciting about it as well is that not everybody can play a musical instrument, but everybody and everything makes a sound. So for me, it becomes a democratic process as well, the ability to turn the world into music.
But while technology has driven this democratization, it's also made natural sound into something to be consumed. And that means it doesn't always retain its integrity or its beauty. Writer and musician David Rottenberg.
When you had high fidelity, you know, LPs in the 60s going to stereo and better quality, people said, what can really test the quality of this medium? Well, some really unusual nature sounds. And then when you had CDs, and they came out in digital sound, could have this kind of crisp production without noise. And then in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, mixed sound recordings appeared digitally. They were this high quality that no one had heard before. But then what happens is there got to be just so many of them, and it's like everything else, you know, mixture was something everyone really liked. It was hard to put into a category of like a kind of music. And like many other things, it became flooded with not so great recordings that was sold in kiosks at the first, like the drug stores and pharmacies and then Walmart, whatever. In one particular line, I think they had Solitudes. And these recordings were especially kind of, you know, generic and just like, here's the sound of the sea, here's some birds. And actually, when you start to look at these things more seriously, there is a whole aesthetic and artistry to soundscape recordings, to phonography, some people call it. It's just the recording and the sounds of the environment. Some are really much better than others.
When sounds optics use the whale song, wave crashing and things like that, what happened particularly in the early 80s was these very so-called ancient sounds or something that reminds us of our past or our heritage or where we came from or something. We often coupled with the most dreadful synthetic presets. You often end up with the most dreadful music, really, that often undercuts on the reasons for using those natural sounds in the first place.
The natural sounds Matthew uses in his music are a long way from comforting New Age atmospheres. On his album One Pig, Matthew documents the life of a pig from birth to plate.
For me, it's impossible to separate the selection of sounds from the social and the physical context of where they come from. We still, in this day and age, we still seek out the natural world as a consequence. I don't wish my music to just simply reassure people that everything is alright by playing a pretty sound of a lark in a field, particularly where I grew up in Kent and the larks, the one with the climb in the area where I grew up. But for me, the act of recording a pig, in some ways, is a metaphor for a friction between us and the natural world. I mean, just on a very basic level, speaking to my friends, I mean, I know this is a very metropolitan perspective, but when was the last time any of them actually saw a pig in the flesh? I mean, probably years ago as a child at a zoo or a farm, going on a school trip or something. So our actual contact with a pig is very, very limited in the flesh, and yet pig products are found in a way that's everything from margarine to lipstick to chicken breast. And obviously bacon and beer, wine, that's absolutely everywhere. So we have a very ambiguous and invisible relationship with the world to a large extent. And part of the attraction for me of working with these sounds is to point my microphone into unamplified worlds and bring them out and allow them to have a voice of their own.
Herbert's mission in a way reflects what happened when the largest mammals on Earth were finally given a voice back in 1970. There's been a lot of feel-good, crystal-gazing diversions along the way, but according to David Rothenberg, who's professor of philosophy and music at New Jersey Institute of Technology, when whale music was first heard, it had a more serious impact.
Until the 1950s, no one had heard these sounds because you need underwater microphones called hydrophones to record these sounds, and the military was developing these things. They were very interested in long-distance underwater communications. They stuck these hydrophones down and they started hearing these amazing patterns that sounded like codes, that sounded like some secret messages. And they said, maybe the Russians have got there before us. It must be something really important. And they were a little disappointed to discover that humpback whales were making these sounds. They hadn't found any secret underwater messages from the enemy. So there was one sonar operator and recorder, Frank Watlington, who said, well, let's give this job to some scientists and see what they can make of these songs. And the first thing they did is release it to the public.
and this record, 1970s, Songs of the Humpback Whale, instantly became a hit. And it still is the best-selling nature sound recording of all time. The song that makes you cry is just incredibly sad sounding. I mean, I know that's part of your beauty, but since they do have this human quality, they have a melancholy effect.
I heard it as a little kid. I don't think it was 1970. It probably was a few years later. I thought it was just really cool, this wild sound, gales underwater. It wasn't just me that felt that way. It was a whole generation. I believe the view that I've read in many places where there really wasn't a movement to save the whales until this song was out in the airwaves and people were hearing it. Whales were certainly in danger because they were being hunted to near extinction. But by and large, the environmental movement did not have much to say about them, and people generally were not interested until they heard this song. And once they heard the song, people started crying. It moved them to tears, and they realized these animals were doing something beautiful and interesting that we really didn't understand, and that we really should do whatever we can to keep them around so we can figure out what they're doing.
During the 70s, Whale Song became a popular backing track.
It's quite true that the same recording, and particularly one part of this recording, Songs of the Humpback Whale, was used by all these different musicians. And it's one particular section that sounds extremely melodic, you know. Ew, 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 something like that. But if you listen to the whole song, which, you know, they can sing for up to 23 hours at a time, a pattern that's about 20 to 30 minutes long, repeated, you hear this all kinds of different, unpredictable sounds almost. And it's a little hard to grasp that the quick sense that people want, a little bit of whale here. So most people who have heard whale songs, they think they say that it's much simpler than it actually is. Very purely and beautifully, unaccompanied except in the background, recording of a humpback whale from Songs of a Humpback Whale with a lot of reverb added to it, echoing in the background. And it's very beautiful and unusual, and this, I believe, was a top 10 song. So that's probably the single most popular song to come out of this.
But there's no word in
I would say the best popular song about discovering humpback whale song is Pete Seeger's tune, The Song of the World's Last Whale. I had read in old newspaper articles there was a Pete Seeger song about humpback whales, and yet there was no recording of it. So I looked online, I found the lyrics to it, and the song was very accurately about recording the song of humpback whales. And this is a really cool song, and it said it had never been recorded. So I just called Pete Seeger up. He lives up the road from me. He said, why didn't you ever record this song? He said, what song? He said, no, The Song of the World's Last Whale. He said, I never wrote a song of that name. I said, yes, you did. I found it on the internet. It has to be true. It goes something like this.
I heard the song of the world's last male.
Oh, that song. Oh, I'm 86 years old. My body remembers that song, but my mind, I can't quite grab onto it. And I said, you should record it. And he said, I'm too old to do a new song. I said, you should do it. That's right, I can't sing. Oh, you should do it. Everyone can sing. And I did end up recording a version of it with a different kind of whales in the background. Fin whales and blue whales and minke whales. Sang in a kind of very slow rhythm. A rhythm that's so slow you have to speed it up by 10 times the years of the rhythm.
As I walked in the moonlight, as we sail, it'll happen to me, and so without fail, if it happens to me, that moonlight sail.
And then, right afterwards, I think the next year, Pete himself recorded it on an album at 89, which I believe won a Grammy Award.
Near an underwater mountain, where's the humpback came? The rover is a microphone, 1/4 mile down. It's on the record, at the taste of round. I didn't just hear it rushing, I didn't just hear it screech. I didn't just hear it bellow, I didn't just hear it screech. It was the musical theme, and the passionate wails came from the heart of the world that's free. Down in the Antarctic, there the heart beats.
Afterwards, I put out my record, Whale Music, which doesn't have any other songs except for that one. The rest is me either playing live with whales out in the fields or playing with recordings of whales in the studio and bending them in the usual way.
It's nearly 5 to 7 now. See if you can figure out what this is.
The low rumbling noises, a humpback whale. You may not have realized it was actually a duet, and the beating sounds, the other sounds, were the tones of a clarinet being played by the American musician and writer David Rothenberg. He told me what was going on.
I was playing live along with this whale. The whale was under the boat pretty close in Hawaii, and I was playing my clarinet into a little microphone on the boat, and that went down into an underwater speaker, broadcasting the sound into the world of the whale. Then I have an underwater microphone where I'm listening to everything going on there, wearing headphones. So I'm listening in on the underwater world and participating in it, trying to play along with this whale, see if he's interested in these strange clarinet sounds.
And was he?
Well, you know, I think he was. I mean, the best parts of this one example. The whale really just seemed to be playing along.
So he was responding. The whale was responding.
Absolutely. It's not that surprising because humpback whales change their song, unlike pretty much any other animal. They change their songs very rapidly and all together as a group. We don't know why they do this. They all want to pick up the new song and all sound the same. And they have this ability to respond very quickly and change what they're doing. And so it's not so surprising that humpback whale will hear a clarinet and start trying out the new sound to see if this is the sound they want to incorporate.
We call it a song. Is it not just a communication
among very complex bird songs like that of a nightingale and a complex whale song, the humpback whale? If you slow down the nightingale song and lower the pitch, have the same structural characteristics of the whale song, even though they're at different frequencies because the whale is singing much lower. Similarly, if you speed up the whale song and raise the pitch, you get something structurally that sounds like what a nightingale is doing. And what interests me about this is these animals are so unrelated to one another. How could they evolve a similarity in strategies of communication?
Watkins has been struck by another similarity between particular bird song and the human voice. I asked him which sounds had most inspired him.
Maybe the hummingbirds, just because they're so unusual. Second, maybe would be the Eastern Screech Owl, which I also used on Circle, and that one is very melancholy, but it's just so haunting. It's hard to imagine that can be a creature. You know, if you've never heard it before, you think, well, what? And those two in particular, because they almost sound human, but yet they're, you know, they're birds. So there's a connection there. It's almost a connection that we're all part of this, and we can't really forget that we're part of the earth. Sometimes I think we do. I think we think we're bigger than it all, and we can just do what we want, and there's no consequence. The most important thing, really, or the message that I hope people would take away from my music is that we should listen a little more carefully to the world. And if we listened a bit more carefully, maybe we would hear a few more stories.
From a psychological point of view, are you surprised that people get more engaged with a cause because of natural sound?
Yeah, I think natural sound can, because it's very evocative, it can really help us maybe more engagement with nature. I think you don't have to have visual access to nature to experience natural sound. You can just go out into a garden and hear the birds singing, or see all the wind around you and hear it in the uplands in the trees. So I think it's a very accessible way of getting into nature. So I think it could certainly be helpful from that point of view in making people feel more connected to the natural world around them.
But when people started to hear whale sounds for the first time, it really spurred on the whole movement to save the whale.
Yeah.
Does that surprise you?
No, it doesn't surprise me. I think it's because people say whale song, it sounds very musical, and of course that's something people can relate to. But it's not so it's the sound of an animal, it's more than that. It's good for people on a different level maybe. So no, I'm not surprised that it would help people gather people for the cause, if you like.
We still look to the natural world for sounds that nurture and comfort us. But this increasingly comes with responsibility.
My counselor this week is an environmentalist. Since the 1970s, he's been telling us that the world is threatened by the carelessness of man, a message which, until recently, seemed to fall on rather deaf ears. Today, however, he finds himself at the center of an increasingly popular movement.
It's significant that when environmentalist Jonathan Porritt visited Sue Lawley's Desert Island in 1989, he chose a sound that was the theme for the burgeoning conservation movement of the 70s.
I've chosen for my next piece, which I'm glad that you allowed me, some of the music from the, you can call it music, from the humpback whale. And I've been a great devotee of whale music for many years, and love these recordings. And it did also just occur to me that maybe as I'm sitting there worrying about whether I'm going to be able to grow my food on the island, that I may be able to commune with the whales by playing this record extremely loud, so they'll come and give me some sort of encouragement in my solitude.
Thank you.
hadn't realised when I embarked on that online search for other people's weather on that sleepless night, it would lead me to an African savannah at a furry barbecue. To North Carolina with a slowed down hummingbird. And deep underwater with whales and a clarinet.
Now, which instance of those eight do you hold most dear?
Well, I'm going to pick the whale music, because I think that actually probably speaks to me more powerfully than all the music put together by human beings.
More than just whale music was presented by 15 Zen, the producer was Maria Burgess. After the news, we continue our classic serial set in London in the 1930s, where Anna and Max face the challenges of life as refugees, rather better than their parents. Bombs on Aunt Daisy. After this look ahead, to Radio 4 Extra.
Rules for a classic detective story. Make sure you include the following key.